It's going to be okay. It's what we say when we don't know what to say to someone who has experienced profound loss. But is it the right thing to say? And if you're the one suffering, is it the right thing to expect? It's the morning show. I'm Dean Kallenbach, in for Kate Archer Kent. Kate is back tomorrow. Our guest is Megan Devine. She's author of a new book called It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Meeting Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. Have you ever had to get through grief? And if so, how did you learn to deal with the reality of loss? We'd especially like to hear from you today by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also connect with us by emailing ideas@wpr.org. You could post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Megan Devine holds a master's in counseling psychology. She writes, speaks, and advocates for those dealing with grief. She manages a website called Refuge in Grief in an effort to provide sanctuary to those in pain and encouragement to those who want to help. Megan Devine, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you introduced the conversation around grief by stating that the way we deal with grief in our culture is broken. That perspective is not only through your formal education, but also through profound personal experience. Can you tell us a little bit about your beginning of your personal journey through grief?
Sure. So I was a psychotherapist for a number of years and was kind of tired of sitting and listening and was planning to sort of reorder my life with my partner. We were going to restructure things so that I could take a break and figure out what was next. But we didn't get a chance to do that. Matt and I had gone out for a swim, a quick dip, as I usually say, in our usual river. But we didn't realize that the river was flooded. It wasn't actually the same river that we knew. So we went in for a swim, and the currents carried him away. And I was in the water trying to get him, and our dog came into the water after me. And the dog and I were carried about 3 miles down the river before she spit us back out on the shore. And then we were lost in the woods for a couple of hours until the dog actually made his way to sort of a housing development where we could find somebody for help or find somebody and call for help. And then the search wardens looked for Matt for about 2 more hours before they found his body in some reeds, not too far from where I had seen him go under.
That's a difficult story to hear. It has to be a difficult one to tell.
It is. And, you know, it's been, you know, at the time that we're speaking, Dean, it's been about 8.5 years. And my voice still cracks when I tell that story. It doesn't get easier with the telling.
And you don't have to tell that story, but you choose to. In other words, certainly to us.
Yeah.
What inspired that?
Making myself tell the story over and over.
Yeah. And doing what you do now.
Yeah. What I found in the days and weeks and months and even years after Matt died was that we don't know how to do grief in this culture. I mean, I was a therapist. It's not like I was new to pain in this life. When Matt died, I wanted to call all of my previous clients and apologize for not knowing what I was doing. It's not entirely true because I know I did good work, but we don't really talk about losses that rearrange the world. If we talk about grief at all, it's in the context of death and dying, and then at the end of a natural, what we expect for a normal Western lifespan, where you get to be sad, but it really shouldn't wreck you for more than a month or two. So even well-meaning friends and family, and certainly the wider community, they didn't really know what to do with me. And one of the big cruelties, not only do you lose somebody you can't live without, but the way that grieving people, the way that I was treated, again, well-meaning and, you know, occasionally not well-meaning, the way that I was treated, the support or lack of support that I experienced, increased my suffering, right? I mean, when something atypical like this happens to you, you already feel like you're on another planet. You already feel different from everybody else, but being told that everything happens for a reason, or you must have needed to learn something really important, right? The things that we say to each other when we see someone in pain actually cause more pain. And I couldn't let people come into the world of grief that I found and experience what I found. I like to say that I have a really big sense of responsibility.
Do you think that your training aided you in dealing with grief, or was that beside the point?
I think it helped and it didn't help. And what I knew as a therapist and what I knew just as who I was in the world, and I never shied away from pain, right? I knew in my training also and in my experience, both professionally and personally, that what I was feeling, what I was living in the aftermath of Matt's death wasn't wrong. I'm really thankful that I knew that, because our culture says that grief is an illness needing a solution. A lot of people feel like what they're feeling after someone they love dies is pathological or broken. And I didn't have that. Mm. And I'm eternally grateful that I knew that.
Yeah. Give us a clear, we talked a little bit of what grief isn't. What is grief? Like a clear definition, maybe clinically, but also experientially, you know, how would you define grief as opposed to other experiences that may be near to it?
Well, I mean, grief is a spectrum, right? We have grief in everyday life when we don't get things that we want or when things are difficult or challenging. So I don't think that we can give a concrete, specific definition that really encompasses grief, the same way that we can't, like, define love in a soundbite.
Yeah.
Grief, the kind that we're talking about right now, is, you know, it's part of love. Right? It's having something or someone you love ripped bodily out of the world. And if you have sort of a visceral gut response to that statement, that's what grief is.
So right? is it just a form of sadness, or is it something different than sadness?
It's more than sadness, right? Because grief encompasses, and we're going to veer into a little bit of like stages of grief type thing here, but like grief contains sadness, it contains rage, it contains sweetness. It contains a lot of things, right? It's a real sense of, in a lot of cases, unreality, right? Like, this can't possibly be true.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I bring up the stages is when I say anger, people go, oh, right, stages of grief, mm-hmm. right? Anger is one of those. No, the stages of grief are a terrible measurement tool or a description of what grief is. You know, it's really hard to contain or define, but it is, it's an acute longing for something you can no longer have that changes fundamentally who you are and how you see the world and how you interact with others.
We're speaking
and it's
with,
not, it, oh, go ahead.
We're speaking with Megan Devine. She's a writer, speaker, and author of the book, It's Okay That You're Not Okay. And she joins us from Oregon, from her home there. So she got up quite early to join us live here this morning. We appreciate it.
Sure.
And again, you're welcome to join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Grief and loss is something that probably eventually happens to everyone. I can't think of too many exceptions to that. Why do you think it's so misunderstood?
Well, I think it's so painful, right? We don't like to think about the people we love dying or being dead and staying dead, right? We don't like to feel that that fear, right? We look at the people we love and we know that they will die, right? People like me, people who have lost babies, people whose parents were killed, certainly with hate crimes and violent crimes that we're hearing more and more of these days, we don't like to look at people like that because we know that very easily we could be in the same position. And that terrifies us, right? Nobody willingly goes into grief. And I think because we know that that could be us so easily, we put a lot of distance mm-hmm. between ourselves and that possibility, right? And we're so afraid of it, we don't talk about it. So that when we need it, not if we need it, we don't know what we're doing because we've never practiced. We've never talked about it. The only thing we've got for how to deal with grief is 40 years old now. And I'm referring to those stages of grief, and they weren't really relevant back then. They didn't really help us back then. They were groundbreaking at the time because nobody was talking about any of this. But, you know, I think in this culture, we're starting maybe to talk about death and dying a little bit more, but grief is still something we don't want to know about.
Yeah. You say in the book that the person who is grieving is not okay and mm-hmm. might never be okay. Where is the hope in that advice?
That's tricky, isn't it? Right? Because I think we've got this binary in our culture in a lot of things, but in this especially, right? Because we say you're either all good, right? Like you grieved correctly, quote unquote, you grieved correctly. You put your loss behind you. You've gone back to normal. You've gone back to a happy, wonderful life, or you haven't done those things and you're rocking in the corner of some basement somewhere wearing sackcloth and never reentering society. Like those are our options. That's not accurate. That's not where any of us really live, right? Mm-hmm. There's a middle ground there where most people and most grieving people find themselves, where you're never going to be okay with the death of your baby, right? You're never going to be okay with the death of a young man who's killed in a violent crime, mm-hmm. right? That's never going to be awesome. But that also doesn't mean that you're eternally broken and eternally doomed, right? The hope is in, I have hope in how we live this. I have hope in how I care for myself inside what is mine to live. For me, that's actual hope, right? It's not hope that things work out in the end, because things don't always work out in the end. That's just reality. If that's the world that we live in, where things don't always work out, and they don't always work out for the best, for me, functionally, the only hope I have, the only hope I can speak about with any confidence is hope for how we live this, hope in how we care for ourselves and how we care for each other. That's a pretty solid hope for me.
Megan Devine is our guest. She's written a book for people dealing with grief or for people who want to help people who are dealing with grief. The book is called It's Okay That You're Not Okay. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to our conversation about grief and dealing with grief and how you not deal with grief sometimes on The Morning Show. I'm Dean Kallenbach. Kate Archer Kent returns tomorrow. Has grieving affected your relationships? Call 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at WPR Mornings. And we've got full phone lines, and we'll get to those calls in a moment. I do want to ask you, though, a lot of what you talk about is how our culture perceives grief and how that's not helpful. Many of us can recite the stages of grief, even though we're not trained mental health professionals. Is that model, I'm hearing you say that model of denial and anger and detachment and bargaining and acceptance, really not as useful as it could or should be? What is the way we perceive grief in our culture? And should we be going?
Yeah, those stages of grief are so pervasive, right? As you said, like we can just rattle them right off. When those stages were written, they were actually written for the dying person, not for those left behind, right? And they weren't meant as a codified system of what will happen. They were meant sort of as a comfort. These are some things that you might encounter, and if you do, they're normal and they're okay, right? But we took that, again, we're so afraid of death and dying. We're so afraid of being the one to live on after our person dies. It makes sense that we sort of cling on to, okay, here's a system. It'll be okay if you follow this. Well, no, because what's happened is now we look at somebody in pain and we say, you're not grieving correctly because I don't see you going through these stages, right? If you're not doing the stages correctly, you're failing grief somehow, as though this were a pass-fail endeavor.
Yeah. And what could be worse than feeling like you're failing at grief?
Right? Right? I mean, you just had your heart ripped out and you have to live the rest of your life without somebody you adore. And now you're getting judged as to how well you're living it. Like, that's just cruel. And I understand the impetus. I understand the desire behind the stages of grief and any other sort of system of categorizing and making sense of such a big emotion and such a big experience, because it is hard to watch people grieve. It is hard to watch somebody you care about be in that kind of pain. We wish we had a system. Well, the systems that we have, they don't work. And mm-hmm. if what you most want is to be supportive of the people you love, then we need to talk about what isn't working. And we have to talk about what might help, right? If your goal is to support your people, let's get you better lined up to maybe have a better shot at that, because the models that we have just aren't working.
Megan Devine, I want to get to some of our callers on this topic of grief. We're with Megan Devine, the author of It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Meeting Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. And our first caller this hour is Christina of Solon Springs. Christina, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just lost my husband in October last year, and I have a little different approach and from my experience. It took, you know, I assisted him in the dying process. I didn't lose him in a sudden accident. And he was 82. And so I grieve, but I have, fortunately, a big support system in my community, in my church. And it is, I am alone. I have moments where I very, very much miss him, but I think it is the individual person has an individual way of grieving, and I think it is a very, very private thing. And if we make it a big issue, I don't think it would help me in my grieving process. So I just see this way. That's my...
Thank you for sharing that, Christina. Megan Devine, what do you think of Christina's situation?
Yeah, first I want to say, Christina, you know, it's so recent, right? I'm so glad to hear that you have support around you. And support, I think, is the biggest thing that gets us through anything, right? Having a community. What I love about what Christina shared here is that grief is individual. This is why a system of right and wrong won't work, right? I mean, the breadth of human experience can't be shrunk down to some, pass-fail thing. The other thing I want to bring up here is the issue of consent, right? Asking questions, being curious. Grief is individual. And so checking in with your grieving person, what would feel useful right now? If I come into somebody and I'm talking about like, okay, this is going to be hard. This is going to be hard for a really long time. And they're feeling, as Christina does, that yes, I miss my person. And I don't want to make this a bigger deal than it feels like for me. You always want to check in with the grieving person to be curious, to wonder, what is this like for you? What would feel useful and supportive? Consent in all things, right? Checking in with your person to find out what they need. That's a great way to approach this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Christina. Let's move on to Vicki of East Troy. Vicki, thank you for joining the morning show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share an experience I had growing up. My mother passed when I was 3 and a half, and I was hitting my 20s and feeling grief again, and like kind of confused about that, thinking, oh, I should be done with this. And I had gone to visit my grandmother, who was 97 years old. She had lost a child, oh, in her 20s on a farming accident. And I sat at her kitchen table, and I said, Grandma, when does this go away? And I remember her very vividly looking at me across the table, and she said, Vicki, it never goes away. She goes, you always have that peace. She goes, but you learn how to deal with it. Each day you grow and you learn a little bit more. She had 16 children, had a full life, and it was so important for me to look across the table and have this woman give me permission to be sad. It was best. So it was a real learning experience for me.
Sounds like your grandmother was wise. Vicki from East Troy, thank you for calling. Megan Devine, any response?
I am so glad to hear that. So I heard your voice break, so mine breaks too, right? I love those conversations, that permission to be sad, right? It is okay to be sad. And I love what your grandmother said there, Vicki, was like, you learn to deal with it, right? Grief gets integrated into our lives. There is never a time when you're not going to miss your mom, right? Death and grief are not a one-time event. You lose your person in the future, right? If your parent dies when you are a small child, you lose the future with your parents, right? Your parent is not going to be there when you graduate from high school. Your parent is not going to be there to worry about you while you're backpacking through Europe, right? It's not a static experience. It is a vacancy that you learn to set up camp beside, to live beside, to integrate into your life.
Vicki, are you still with us?
Yeah, I am.
I'm curious, you know, if she died at three, how much do you actually remember about her as opposed to what you missed?
I have snippets, you know, remember her holding me in a closet or building a snowman. And it's more of a feeling and a sense of who the person was. That's kind of what I'm left with. But something that was interesting for me growing up is I was blessed to have a beautiful second mother who just loves me to pieces. So there was a lot of growing up, there was a lot of guilt in still and not being able to sort out that gray matter, thinking everything was black and white, as in I couldn't love two women at the same time, and not really having anybody in my immediate family to talk to about it because it made people sad. So I often would go to my grandparents to discuss that. Well, not often, but, you know, when I felt comfortable. You know, so it was a interesting situation because you didn't want to hurt anybody else's feelings either.
Vicki, thank you for sharing. Let's move to another caller. Let's go to Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you. First, I'd just like to say my heart goes out to all of you because, I mean, we all go through this at some point. My comment is it's not exactly grief in terms of the loss of somebody due to death. I got divorced going on almost 5 years now, and my ex-wife, she left because she wanted to be with somebody else. I felt like at the time when I got divorced, it should have just been like a bullet to my heart, and I should have just died. Like, because it literally is like losing that person that I love more than anything. I define myself by being a good husband and a good father, and then to have somebody tell you that, you know, that they're leaving, and I feel like that the grief from that, just because there's no sense of closure, and I guess I was just wondering if you had any suggestions, Megan, or because I've been told that, you know, feeling this way is not okay.
Mm. Yeah, you bring up such a good point, Marcus. Thank you for sharing that with us. I think we can get into sort of these grief Olympics, right, where that's not a death, it's not that important. And I think we've got a spectrum of cruelty inside all grief, right? We've got a really short time limit on how long it's okay to be sad or to be angry or to feel jilted in any kind of loss, right? I was doing a conference a couple of years ago speaking to medical providers, doctors and surgeons and such. And one of the doctors said, well, what about when you've got a client who comes in and you've been seeing them for a few years now, and they're still talking about a loss that they suffered from years ago. They're still talking about it. And you could hear in their voice how not cool that was. And my response to that was, you know, somebody who is, quote unquote, still talking about something that broke their heart, I can tell you that they haven't yet felt heard. Right? That's not perseverating. That is, they haven't yet felt heard in their sadness, in their pain. It's okay that you're still sad, that you still think about this loss and how much that hurt your heart and changed your life. Of course it's okay that you're still sad, right? Being acknowledged inside that, like, it doesn't change anything, but it also changes everything. I think when we feel like we have to hide our sadness or pretend it isn't there, we can get defensive, right, about the right to be in whatever state we're in. Does that make sense?
I think so. Thank you. Megan Devine is our guest. She's a writer, speaker, and author of the book, It's Okay That You're Not Okay. Let's move now to another caller, Ted from Spooner. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. I guess I don't know how to deal with grief or death anymore since I was in Vietnam. I had to help in casualty and receiving, and you've seen death day in and day out. So it feels like I lost part of grieving.
Megan Devine, Ted was exposed to an awful lot of death. Can that affect your ability to grieve?
Yeah, right. Thank you for your service, Ted. The spectrum, I keep coming back to this spectrum of loss and grief and death and dying that we have in this world. There is horror in this world that we commit, that we witness, that we receive. We can't even begin to absorb what happens in this world. And we certainly don't want to talk about it. And this is why our returning vets have such a hard time coming back to, you know, this wider life, because we don't talk about any of this stuff. And it does impact your relationships. It impacts how you see the world. It impacts how you see your place in the world. And because we've got this model, especially in Western culture, that you're either entirely healed or eternally broken, we can't figure out how to live in that middle ground. And until we can start talking about how much it hurts to be here, how we care for each other, how we withstand hearing the reality that somebody else lives and the pain and anguish that they carry, until we get better at hearing that without trying to fix it, we're not going to get better at this. It's not like death and dying and atrocities and all of these things, it's not like they're going to stop.
And
we've got to start talking about them. Yeah.
And I would think that the fact that it was also Vietnam and the way Vietnam veterans had little opportunity or option to talk about things when they returned in general, and then to have that duty stacked on top of it would seem to be a pretty tough thing to go through.
Absolutely. Ted, there's a great book written by a Vietnam vet called At Hell's Gate by Claude Anshin Thomas. That might be something for you to check out. And for any of you other vets listening, he writes beautifully about that middle ground, right? Being really clear about what he saw and what he participated in and what he's living, and trying to find some peace in himself alongside that without prettying up that reality. It's a great resource.
Thank you. Megan Devine is a writer, speaker, and author of the book, It's Okay That You're Not Okay. We're talking about grief this hour. Let's be joined by Laura from Madison. Welcome to the Ideas Network, Laura. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I wanted to talk a little bit about disenfranchised grief and how there are grieving types of grief that society often doesn't even recognize, that makes it so hard for the individual who to move through whatever process they need to go through. I mean, there are a lot of different types of disenfranchised grief, but loss of agency, I think, the loss of it can be a physical loss, it can be a mental loss. We start grieving even before a person has passed on. Anyways, would you speak to this?
Yes, sure. Thank you for bringing that up. So disenfranchised grief, as you described, is like grief that isn't recognized as a loss, right? We have such a, it's like we have a finite amount of compassion and attention, and if we give it at all, it's for the big things. So in the death spectrum, we've got like, the death of your best friend or the death of a sibling. That is a big one that doesn't get a lot of attention. Then there are the non-death related losses that don't get a lot of attention, those disenfranchised griefs. I love that you brought up loss of agency, right? Like life-changing accident or illness, something that changes fundamentally the way that you move in the world. We've got this this addiction to transformation, right? It's in all of our entertainment. If somebody has a life-altering accident and they're in a wheelchair, well, we expect them to come back powerful and inspirational and transform the way we look at ableism and, all of this stuff, which has its place, right? But it means that we don't talk about that loss of agency. We don't talk about how hard it is to live in a body or a world that isn't what it used to be, right? So when I talk about grief, I'm not just talking about these out of order or atypical deaths like mine and like a lot of my students and clients have experienced. I'm talking about all of the ways that the world changes, all of the ways that our hearts get broken. We're not very good at talking about any of those, right? The cool thing is that it gets easier the more you talk about it. I think we freeze up in the face of a lot of loss and we think, I don't know what to say. So maybe I shouldn't think about it anymore so I don't feel so helpless. But that's never going to get us where we want to go, right? That's never going to help us learn the skills we need to care for each other and care for ourselves. You have to sort of push through that helplessness and go, oh, I actually don't know what I'm doing, and that's cool. It's okay that I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm just going to show up and ask questions and acknowledge the fact that I can't fix this.
Our topic through the hour is grief and exploring new models for dealing with profound loss. Our guest is Megan Devine, who manages the website Refuge in Grief and has written the book It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Meeting Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. Kate Archer-Kent will be back tomorrow. I'm Dean Kallenbach. Our topic this hour is grief. What do you do to support people who are grieving? 800-642-1234 is our number. We have one line open, 800-642-1234. Our guest is Megan Devine, a writer, speaker, and author of the book, It's Okay That You're Not Okay. And we'll get to the phones in just a bit. But Megan Devine, grief is obviously an emotional experience, but in your book you describe physical and mental manifestations of grief as well. How does grief affect our body and our mind?
I think one of the challenges, one of the many challenges, or one of the many problems with not talking about grief is we don't know what's normal because we don't talk about it. So grief is a full body experience. It can affect your memory. It can affect your appetite. Some people sort of stop eating the grief diet. Some people eat a lot. Your sleep can be impacted. Your memory, definitely. One of the things that really surprised me after Matt died was, so I've always been a really voracious reader, and I could not read more than, you know, the back of a cereal box for a long time after he died. My comprehension was off. My attention span was non-existent, right? So for a lot of people, that's really weird to lose big chunks of who you are and how you identify, right? Like, you can also get physical pains, right? Matt had sciatica pretty badly. I'd never had it before. In the first year after Matt died, my body sort of adopted his sciatica,
wow.
Adopted his heartburn. Now, who knows why that stuff happens? Right? I mean, just in the normal world, there's more than we know going on. And so lots of really odd things happen. And, you know, again, this is why it's so important that we talk about these. When I talk to somebody who's in the first year or two of grief, and they say, like, okay, this really weird thing is happening to me, and they share something about something physical that's going on with them, where they keep leaving their keys in the freezer. And I say, all of that is weird and it's totally normal. Their relief is palpable. When we think that everything about grief is wrong, we don't talk about this stuff. And so stuff that's really normal, people are really worried about, or they're embarrassed to say anything, right? This is why we got to bring grief out of the closet, right? Because like, things happen and they're normal, and it doesn't mean you're losing your mind. It means you're in pain.
One quote from the book that I thought was interesting is, nothing brings out the crazy in a family quite like death. Can you talk about how death throws a monkey wrench into family dynamics?
Absolutely. So even the best of families, even the best of friend networks, a blow like this shakes everybody up. Feelings get hurt a lot, right? Hidden agendas, that sounds really nefarious, but like, hidden agendas come out, especially if your person didn't have advance directives or a living will or any of their legal paperwork together. Shout out, please get your legal paperwork together, even if you think you will never die. If there wasn't something really clear and legal like that, there can be battles among family members about what should be done with somebody's body, what should be done with their possessions. If you are an unmarried partner and your partner dies, you're a widow, but you're not necessarily given legal status, right? Mm-hmm. You might have family members come in and take everything because they don't recognize you as a partner.
Right.
Who deserves that space and that time, right? So interpersonally, things get really wonky. That is not always the case. I don't want anybody feeling like they need to call in and say, my family was amazing, because some families are amazing, right? We don't want to paint any of this with the same brush or one big wide brush, right? It's like, but death and grief, it's so distressing. It's so disturbing to our comfortable fabric of reality that people get weird.
Well, you take those side effects and you multiply them by all the people affected by it, and it's going to make some differences, I would think.
It makes some differences. And remembering that we take all of that stuff and we put it into a system that doesn't know how to talk about what's hard. We don't really know how to talk about, so I notice that, you know, when we drove past the grocery store, you started yelling. Like, we don't know how to dissect our interpersonal conversations. We don't really practice empathy or connection for the most part on a daily basis. So we're thrown into this situation and we don't know what we're doing. It can be really messy.
Let's try to take some more phone calls now. Let's go next to Nancy in Grafton. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning. When I was 14 years old, it was a week before Christmas. I was the oldest of six kids. My mother was killed by a drunk driver. Week before Christmas, day before my sister Mary's birthday. My mother was buried the day before her 32nd birthday. Well, anyway, so as time goes by, I grew up. Got married, had 14 kids. Our Our son Leo went through the ice in Grafton here on a snowmobile and drowned. Our grandson down in Texas was killed on a motorcycle. Well, right up the street from our house here, about two blocks or three, is a cemetery. And that's where they're sleeping. And then this last July, my husband Bob passed away, and he kept saying he was in a lot of pain. And we were all there at the hospital, and he said, "It's okay, it's okay." And he passed away. But, you know, he had a, we always were polka dancers, and we had a massive polka celebration, and it was the most joyful thing. The thing is, I think God gets us through all kinds of things. We've always been very, all my life, always very church-going, you know, and our whole family. And, you know, I always say, if it turns out that, you know, there'd be not a doggone thing when we pass away, that doesn't help us any, because, heck, as long as we're believing while we're here, it gives us peace. And I take Bob's picture, and I put on some polka music, and Bob and I are dancing again, you know, and I just believe in that reunion, and that, what the heck were you doing? How are you? You know?
So Nancy's found a way to dance through her grief.
Well, that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing all of that with us, Nancy. So much loss in a lifetime. And I'm gonna imagine that, you and your husband polka dancing. So I think this is a great time to sort of talk about our beliefs, our spiritual and our religious beliefs, whether we have them or don't have them. I mean, it's certainly not my place to say what's right and what's wrong, because I don't think there's a right and a wrong answer here. I go back to what I said about consent in all things. We want to wonder for people, is there anything that companions you inside this? Is it a sense of God or more than this? Is it science? Is it beauty? And then to honor what they feel is there is a companionable something. I think what gets tricky is that we tell people what they should or should not believe. We believe that what brings us comfort should bring another person comfort, and then we're offended when that's not true. The same way that I want to encourage us to honor our own grief and honor each other's griefs, I want to encourage us to be curious about others' beliefs. Again, whether that is a religious or spiritual belief or it is not, to allow that sovereignty, that personal choice. If I say to somebody, God will get you through this, and that is not their universe, that's not their belief system, that's not going to help them, right? It's more powerful, it's more helpful if we inquire, right? If we let the grieving person lead and find out what is a true companion or a true comfort to them and help them lean into that.
Thank you, Nancy. Let's move to Christine in Milwaukee. Christine, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you. So about 6 years ago, I had a stillborn baby at 39 weeks, and that was really, really painful. And, you know, one of the hardest things that I thought would ever happen to me, and I had a big support network, and I managed to get through it somehow, I think, because I then had two beautiful girls. So fast forward 6 years later, and at the end of December, around Christmas, my dad died. And I was pregnant and found out a couple weeks later that into my second trimester, I had a miscarriage, and it happened at home. I miscarried at home. And so now I'm dealing with, you know, multiple losses, my dad and a miscarriage, and I, you know, never, of course, got over the first stillborn baby. So my question is twofold. One is, I think people don't even know what to do with me anymore. Like, there's that sad, you know, my sad friend, and all these bad things happen to her, and I don't even know what to say to people when they try to comfort me. My second thing is, because these bad things have happened, I keep thinking, what else is going to happen? What next? What do I say to my girls? So if you have any input on that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing all of that. And you bring up two really important things here. One is people don't know what to do with me, right? And I think there is that thing that, like, you can't hide these losses, right? We don't appear, quote unquote, normal to the outside world anymore, and people are very careful, right? I think especially when we have a good support network, they want so badly to be supportive, to give you acknowledgement, to care for you well, that sometimes even that can be a lot, right? I think that there can also be some pressure on the grieving person to tell their friends and family how to best support them. That's a lot of emotional labor. That's a lot of work for somebody to do, especially as you said, like, I don't know how to tell them to help me, right? There's no really easy, elegant solution here. It's about, one of the best things that a dear friend of mine used to say to me whenever she would speak to me is, how is today? Mm. Right? Instead of how are you? How are you is a gigantic question that has no answer, right? How is today is a great question, right? And I think for support people, being willing to feel weird about it, but doing it anyway, right? The people who can say, I have no idea how to do this, and I feel like a complete, novice and an idiot that I don't know how to do this, but I'm here and I love you and I'm willing to look awkward because I want to be here with you, right? So there's that piece. And then I think you also, like, I love that you brought up, I can't look at the world in any other way than I do now. Like, what loss is coming next? Mm. Right? Those of us who have lived unlikely things can never trust in a beneficent world again. We don't have that innocence. We don't have that ability to believe that things will work out okay, right? You don't have that same cushion of things are likely to work out. Well, they haven't worked out in the past, right? So again, it becomes, we go back to where we started, Dean, with that question of hope, right? You can't hope in things working out for the best when you know better. And that doesn't mean you have to walk around afraid of everything either, right? It's that middle ground that we're talking about. I have hope in how I care for myself no matter what comes. I have hope in the relationships that I create, in the net that supports me. I have hope in how I care for myself, right? Not hope in how things turn out, because we can't believe in that. That sounds to some people like a really dismal way to live, but I think it's beautiful.
And I'll point out that there are opportunities to interact more with Megan Devine on her website, Refuge in Grief. Thank you, Megan Devine, a writer, speaker, and author of the book, It's Okay That You're Not Okay. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
The Morning Show is produced by Michelle Johnson as executive producer, and Nyasia Ellison produced this hour. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley answers your questions about personal finance. I'm Dean Kallenbeck, in for Kate Archer Kent. Kate will be back tomorrow. You've been listening to The Morning Show, and this is the Ideas Network.